This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Princess Diarist by Carrie Fisher, read by the author. Journal entries read by Billy Lord. This is Carrie Fisher. It was 1976. Charlie's Angels, Laverne and Shirley, and Family Feud premiered on TV. Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs founded the Apple Computer Company in a garage. The Food and Drug Administration banned red dye number 2 after it was found to cause tumors in the bladders of dogs. Howard Hughes died at age 70 of kidney failure in a private jet en route to a Houston hospital. He was worth more than $2 billion and weighed 90 pounds. Anne Rice's debut novel, Interview with a Vampire, was published. Israel rescued 102 Air France passengers who were being held hostage at the Entebbe airport in Uganda. The Queen sent the first royal email. London was bombed by the IRA and the Sex Pistols, and Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody went gold. Andy Williams' ex-wife, Claudine Langer, accidentally, she claimed, shot her skier lover, Spider Savage, to death. A Pennsylvania congressman won renomination for a 12th term despite having been dead for 2 weeks. Caitlyn Jenner, still Bruce then, won the gold medal in the Olympic decathlon and the title World's Greatest Athlete. So many things were happening. The first Ebola outbreak occurred in Africa. There was a panic over swine flu. And in a contaminated Philadelphia hotel, Legionnaires' disease killed 29 people. A military coup deposed Argentina's president, Isabel Perón. Sal Mineo was stabbed to death, and Agatha Christie and André Malraux died, though not together. Saul Bellow won the Pulitzer Prize for Humboldt's Gift and the Nobel Prize for Literature for his body of work. Son of Sam killed his first victim. Riots in Soweto marked the beginning of the end of apartheid in South Africa. The rock band that would become U2 was formed. The United States Tennis Association barred transsexual Renee Richards from playing in the U.S. Open. Network gave us Howard Beale's iconic rant, "I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore." And Paul Simon won the Grammy Award for Album of the Year for Still Crazy After All These Years. Jimmy Carter beat Gerald Ford even after saying in a Playboy interview that he lusted after women in his heart. Ryan Reynolds and Benedict Cumberbatch were born, as were Colin Farrell, Rashida Jones, Alicia Silverstone, Rick Ross, Anna Faris, Peyton Manning, Audrey Tautou, Ja Rule, and Reese Witherspoon. George Harrison was found guilty of plagiarizing "He's So Fine" from My Sweet Lord. Buffalo Bills running back O.J. Simpson had the best game of his career, rushing a then-record 273 yards and scoring 2 touchdowns against the Detroit Lions. Mao Zedong died. The Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty, ruling that this punishment was not particularly cruel or unusual. The Band played its farewell concert in San Francisco. Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton separated after 4 months of marriage, which had been preceded by 16 months of divorce. America celebrated its bicentennial. I think you get the picture. It was a year that, like all years, a lot of things happened in. People were on TV or in movies. They wrote songs that were liked more than other songs. While other people excelled at sports, and, as always, a lot of accomplished and famous people died. But through it all, one big thing that was beginning to happen, and that still, lo these many decades later, hasn't stopped happening, is Star Wars. We were filming Star Wars in London in 1976, and none of us in the cast had any idea how significantly our lives would be altered when the movie premiered the following year. Cut to 2013. Much the same kinds of things were happening, only faster and more intensely. And George Lucas announced that the Star Wars franchise was starting up again, and that the original cast would be in it. Well, I was surprised. As surprised as you can be and still be so far over 40. I mean, I thought they might make more Star Wars movies. Not that I thought about it all that much, but I doubted that I would find myself in them. And now it looked like I would. Hallelujah. Not because I liked appearing up on a screen. I didn't like it when I was the age one could like it. But now they had 3D and high def and such, so that all your wrinkles and withered puffiness need their own agents. So if I didn't like it then, I'd never like it now, and going forward to eventually. The bummer was that I wouldn't be able to watch the new sequel, not with me in it. Oh, but to hell with that. Someone could tell me about it. If I was going to do the new Star Wars, they'd have to pay me something, even though the cloud of doubt could easily and gradually be cast over that potential fact based on some of the history of the Star Wars company. No merchandising? But maybe I'll get some this time. And they'd have us all over the barrel of our wanting to be in it. And they could just as easily write any of us out. Well, maybe not easily, but they could write us out if we wrangled too long over what we wanted to be paid. And by we, in this case, I meant I. And as much as I may have joked about Star Wars over the years, I liked that I was in those films, particularly as the only girl in an all-boy fantasy. They were fun to make. It was an anecdote of unimaginable standing. I liked being Princess Leia, or Princess Leia being me. Over time, I thought that we'd melded into one. I don't think you could think of Leia without my lurking in that thought somewhere. And I'm not talking about masturbation. So, Princess Leia are us. Bottom line, I was going to be able to pay some, if not all, of my overhead again. Maybe not now, but soon. Sure, if it wasn't very soon, I'd be paying bills from an apartment, but at least I'd be able to buy stuff I didn't need again. Stuff I didn't need, and in such unnecessary quantities. I'd maybe even have a charge at Barney's again soon. Oh, life was good. Public life, that is. Swimming pools, movie stars. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is how my whole new Star Wars adventure began again. Like an acid flashback, only intergalactic, in the moment, and essentially real. Who do I think I would have been if I hadn't been Princess Leia? Am I Princess Leia, or is she me? Split the difference, and you'd be closer to the truth. Star Wars was and is my job. It can't fire me, and I'll never be able to quit. And why would I want to? That's both a rhetorical and a real question. Today, while going through some boxes containing some old writing of mine, I found the diaries I kept while filming the first Star Wars movie 40 years ago. Stay tuned. Life before Leia. 2 years before Star Wars, I'd been in a film called Shampoo, starring and produced by Warren Beatty, and directed by Hal Ashby. I played the part of Lee Grant's angry, promiscuous daughter, who ends up having sex with her mother's lover, hairdresser. The starring role played, of course, by Warren. It was he, along with the screenwriter Robert Towne, who hired me for the pissed-off daughter role. At the time, the last thing I thought I wanted to do was go into show business. A fickle occupation that doled out a sense of uneasiness and humiliation like tepid snacks at movie screenings. This uneasiness was nurtured by the almost invisible diminishment over time of one's popularity. First you're in movies, a few small parts in popular films. Then, if it happens, the thing all actors are waiting for, stardom. You're a years in the making, overnight success. I had missed the early giddy portion of my parents' rise to success. I arrived on the scene when my mother, Debbie Reynolds, was still making good, big-budget films at MGM. But as I grew up and my consciousness all too slowly snapped into focus, I noticed that the films were not what they had originally been. Her contract expired when she was in her late 30s. I recall her last MGM Studios film at 40 was of the horror variety entitled What's the Matter with Helen? And her co-star, far from being Gene Kelly's Singing in the Rain, was Shelley Winters, who somewhat thoughtlessly killed her at the film's close. Soon after this, my mother began doing nightclub work in Las Vegas at the now-defunct Desert Inn. Coincidentally, I also began doing nightclub work, singing I Got Love and Bridge Over Troubled Water in her show. It was a huge step up for me from high school. My younger brother Todd accompanied me on guitar, and my mother's backup singers danced and sang behind me, something that at occasional odd moments throughout my life I've wished that they continued to do. My mother then took a modified version of this show to theaters and fairs across America. After that, she did a Broadway musical. I was then one of the backup singers behind her, where backup singers tend to lurk. She then continued to do her nightclub act for the next 40 years, with forays into television shows and films, most notably Albert Brooks's Mother. My father, Eddie Fisher, played in nightclubs until he was no longer asked to. And when he wasn't asked to, it was in part because, as a crooner, he was no longer relevant. And in part because he was more interested in sex and drugs than anything else. Shooting speed for 13 years can really put a crimp in whatever career you might otherwise be attempting to sustain. Ask around. Periodically, he would manage to secure a book deal or, well, actually, that's it. No one could take the risk of hiring him to sing. He could easily be a no-show, and his vocal range was severely limited by his debauched lifestyle. Also, people found it difficult to forgive him for leaving my mother for Elizabeth Taylor all those years ago, causing him to be viewed for his remaining years as America's cad. One day, when I was about 12, I was sitting in my grandmother's lap. Not a good idea at any age, given that Maxine Reynolds was, to say the least, not a cuddly woman. When she suddenly asked my mother, "Hey, did you ever get those tickets to Annie that I asked you for?" She regarded my mother with suspicious eyes. My grandmother had three looks, glaring suspiciously, glaring hostily, and glaring with disappointment. Active disappointment, lively disappointment, condescending disappointment. "Oh, I'm sorry, Mama," my mother responded. "Is there another show you want to see? Annie seems to be sold out for the whole month. I've tried everywhere." My grandmother pursed her lips, giving the appearance of someone who smelled something bad. Then she pushed air out of her nose and pronounced a very disappointed, "It used to mean something in this town to be Debbie Reynolds," she said. "Now she can't even get a few measly show tickets." I involuntarily squeezed my grandmother, as if to do so would push all future demeaning remarks out of her stocky little body. It was episodes like this that made me decide I never wanted to be in show business. So, why did I agree to visit the set of Shampoo, knowing there might be a role in the film that I was right for? Go figure. Maybe I wanted to see what it felt like to be wanted by Warren Beatty in any capacity at all. At any rate, at 17, I didn't see it as a career choice. Or perhaps I was kidding myself. Lord knows it wouldn't be the last time in my life that I would do that. Kidding yourself doesn't require that you have a sense of humor. But a sense of humor comes in handy for almost everything else, especially the darker things, which this did not fall anywhere under the heading of. I got the role of Lorna in Shampoo. Lorna, the daughter of Jack Warden and Lee Grant. I basically had one scene, and that scene was with Warren, who played my mother's and everyone else's in the film's hairdresser and lover. My character doesn't like her mother and has never had her hair done, i.e., slept with her hairdresser. Was Lorna's not getting her hair done a way of rebelling against her mother? Possibly. Was propositioning her mother's hairdresser a way of screwing with her hated mother? Absolutely. Would Lorna have been sorry if her father found out? Probably. Or not. You pick. In the film, I'm discovered on the tennis court wearing a tennis outfit, holding a racket and standing next to a tennis pro who is hitting balls as I watch Warren arrive. I inform him that my mother is not at home and take him to the kitchen, where I ask him if he's making it with my mother and if he wants anything to eat. I tell him I've never been to a hairdresser, that I'm nothing like my mother, and ask him if he wants to fuck. The scene ends with my proposition, and we then find me in the bedroom, post-coitally reapplying my headscarf. Why did I wear a headscarf, you most likely fail to wonder? Because I, Carrie, had short hair. The kind you get from going to a hairdresser. So, I had to wear a wig to show that a visit to a hairdresser was not something that would ever be found on my schedule. I wore the scarf because the wig looked less like a wig that way. The other big question you're probably not asking yourself is, did I wear a bra under my tennis outfit? And if I didn't, why didn't I? Simple. Warren, the star, co-writer, and producer of Shampoo, was asked by the costume department if he wanted me to wear a bra under my tennis clothes or not. Warren squinted in the general direction of my breasts. Is she wearing one now? I stood there as if my breasts and I were somewhere else. Yes, responded Aggie, the costume designer. Warren pursed his lips thoughtfully. Let's see it without. I followed Aggie to my hamster cage trailer and removed my bra. Whereupon I was returned to Warren's scrutiny forthwith. Once again, he squinted at my chest impassively. And this is without? He asked. Yes, Aggie groaned. Let's go without, he pronounced, directed, charged, commanded. My breasts and I followed Aggie back to my dressing zone, and the subject was closed. My braless Shampoo breasts can be ogled on YouTube, or LubeTube, as can my no underwear in space look in the first Star Wars, and the metal bikini, or Jabba Killer, in the third, now confusingly known as Episodes 4 and 6. My two scenes in Shampoo took only a few days to shoot, and when they were done, I went back to living at home with my mother and younger brother Todd, hoping I wouldn't be living there for too much longer, as any amount of time was way too long for the now too hip for words me. I had never had an audition like the one I had with Terrence Malick, the director of Days of Heaven. I recall sitting with him for over an hour and talking. Not just me talking, thank God, though I do think the emphasis was on getting to know me and what I was like. After all, I hadn't called him into a room to meet about a movie I was making. I remember telling him far too much about myself, a habit that would only increase as I aged. But as a teenager, I didn't yet have that big of a repertoire of anecdotes. One of my best up to that time had to do with the comic Rip Taylor. He and my mom did a show together in Vegas, and his gay secretary, Lynn. I had a crush on Lynn. He was good-looking, wore an ascot, and was really dainty, like if you breathed on him, he would fall over like a feather in the wind. Lynn used to call me his love apple, and we would make out on the cruise bus. If I'd been in high school instead of doing shows with my mother, I'd have had appropriate venues for my adolescent feelings to emerge. I would have lived a life as a teenager. But since I wasn't living that life, I kept having crushes on gay men. Besides Lynn, there was also Albert, who was a dancer in the Broadway show Irene with Debbie. He was attractive and gay, although in my uninformed opinion, you wouldn't pick him out as gay. And we used to make out in the dressing rooms. My mom knew about this, so what the fuck was that about? I was only 15 and I was jailbait. And my mom said, if you want to have sex with Albert, I'll watch if you like, so I can give instructions. To be fair, my mom was really distracted then. Her whole life was falling apart, so she was trying to anchor it by providing some motherly love. There aren't many perfect moments to air out a story like that, so I'm fairly certain Terry Malick heard about Lynn and Albert and my mom. He seemed the type of person who was interested in hearing just about any weird story you had that left you feeling frightened and alone. He did a lot of improvisation in his films, so these interviews may have been his way of determining if his actors were comfortable in their own skin. I'm someone who's very comfortable in my own skin. I just wish there wasn't so much room at times for that comfort. We had several such meetings together before Malick had me read with John Travolta. John was famous then from his television sitcom Welcome Back, Cotter. It seemed to be understood that John had the inside track for the lead role in Days of Heaven, and in the few times we read together, John and I had great chemistry. Like two beakers containing flammable liquid, we bubbled along together comfortably. If John starred in Days of Heaven, would I star alongside him? Things were looking good for me. And then, for some reason, John couldn't do the film. So John was out and Richard Gere was in. I read with Richard Gere. Let's just say our beakers didn't bubble with compatibility. So now I was out and Brooke Adams was in. My potential career as a serious-ish actress was, for now anyway, at an end. It would take more than a cameo in the Blues Brothers to get people to stop thinking of me as Princess Leia. Days of Heaven was a wonderful film, and perhaps would have delayed me a little, but my very, very light cross to bear would always be that I would be known as Princess Leia, and not as that girl who was so good in one of Terry Malick's early masterpieces. I auditioned for other films, Grease and The Fortune, Then I applied to two drama schools in England. The Royal Academy of Dramatic Art would have none of me, but the Central School of Speech and Drama, whose notable alumni included Laurence Olivier, Harold Pinter, and the Redgrave sisters, said yes. This was what I'd been fairly selfishly waiting for, the chance to stop living at home with, or even in the same country with, my newly divorced, newly brokish, emotionally broken mother. As a bonus, I got real acting experience, which I'd never had, partly because I still wasn't so sure I wanted to be an actress. But maybe it was something I could do without a high school diploma or accredited skills of any kind whatsoever. A job that would pay me enough of a wage to let me go out into the world and start what I would laughingly come to call my own actual life. When I began attending Central, I was 17 and the youngest student there. It was the first time I actually lived on my own. I was finally away from my mother, whom I'd happily live off of but not with, in an apartment I was subletting from a friend, where no one could be disappointed in me. And if someone oddly should be, I didn't care, because they weren't related to me. Upside down and unconscious with yellow eyes. George Lucas held his auditions for Star Wars in an office on a lot in Hollywood. It was in one of those faux Spanish cream-colored buildings from the 30s, with dark orange-tiled roofs and black iron grated windows, lined with sidewalks and turn lined with trees. Pine trees, I think they were. The sort that shed their needles generously onto the street below, and interrupted by parched patches of once green lawns. Everything was a little worse for the wear, but good things would happen in these buildings. Lives would be led, businesses would prosper, and men would attend meetings, hopeful meetings, meetings where big plans were made and ideas were proposed. But of all the meetings that had ever been held in that particular office, none of them could compare in world impact with the casting calls for the Star Wars movie. A plaque could be placed on the outside of this building that states, "On this spot, the Star Wars films conducted their casting sessions. In this building, the actors and actresses entered and exited until only three remained. These three were the actors who ultimately played the lead parts of Han, Luke, and Leia." I've told the story of getting cast as Princess Leia many times before, in interviews, on horseback, and in cardiac units. So if you've previously heard this story before, I apologize for requiring some of your coveted store of patience. I know how closely most of us tend to hold on to whatever cache of patience we've managed to amass over a lifetime, and I appreciate your squandering some of your cherished stash here. George gave me the impression of being smaller than he was because he spoke so infrequently. I first encountered his all but silent presence at these auditions, the first of which he held with the director Brian De Palma. Brian was casting his horror film Carrie, and they both required an actress between the age of 18 and 22. I was 19 at the time, so I read for both George and Brian. George had directed two other feature films up till then, THX 1138, starring Robert Duvall, and American Graffiti, starring Ron Howard and Cindy Williams. Well, and Richard Dreyfuss. The roles I met with the two directors for that first day were Princess Leia in Star Wars and Carrie in Carrie. I thought that last role would be a funny casting coup if I got it. Carrie as Carrie in Carrie. I doubt that that was why I never made it to the next level with Carrie, But it didn't help, as far as I was concerned, that there would have to be a goofy film poster advertising a serious horror film. I sat down before the two directors behind their respective desks. Mr. Lucas was all but mute. He nodded when I entered the room, and Mr. De Palma took over from there. He was a big man, and not merely because he spoke more, or spoke, period. Brian sat on the left and George on the right, both bearded, as if you had two choices in director sizes. Only I didn't have the choice. They did. Brian cleared his bigger throat of bigger things and said, "So, I see here you've been in the film Shampoo." I knew this, so I simply nodded, my face in a tight, white-toothed smile. Maybe they would ask me something requiring more than a nod. "Did you enjoy working with Warren?" "Yes, I did." That was easy. I had enjoyed working with him. But Brian's look told me that that wasn't enough of an answer. He was... what was he? They needed to know. He helped me work a lot. I mean, he and the other screenwriter, they worked with me. Oh, my God, this wasn't going well. Mr. De Palma waited for more, and when more wasn't forthcoming, he attempted to help me. "How did they work with you?" "Oh, that's what they wanted to know. Well, they had me do the scene over and over and with food. There was eating in the scene. I had to offer Warren a baked apple. And then I ask him if he's making it with my mother. Sleeping with her, you know." George almost smiled. Brian actually did. "Yes, I know what making it means." I flushed. I considered stopping this interview then and there. But I soldiered on. "No, no, no, that's the dialogue. Are you making it with my mother?" I asked him that because I hate my mother. Not in real life. I hate my mother in the movie. Partly because she's sleeping with Warren, who's the hairdresser. Lee Grant played my mom, but I didn't really have any scenes with her, which is, well, too bad because she's a great actress. And Warren is a great actor. He also wrote the movie with Robert Towne, which is why they both worked with me. With food. It sounded a lot more natural when you talk with food in your mouth. Not that you do that in your movies. Maybe in the scary movie, but I don't know the food situation in space. The meeting seemed to be going better. "And what have you done since Shampoo?" George asked. I repressed the urge to say that I had written three symphonies and learned how to perform dental surgery on monkeys, and instead told the truth. "I went to school in England, drama school. I went to the Central School of Speech and Drama." I was breathless with information. I mean, I didn't just go. I'm still going. I'm home on Christmas vacation. I stopped abruptly to breathe. Brian was nodding, his eyebrows heading off to his hair in something like surprise. He asked me politely about my experience at school, and I responded politely as George watched impassively. I would come to discover that George's expression wasn't indifference or anything like it. It was shy and discerning, among many other things, including intelligent, studious, and, well, and a word like darling. Only not that word. It's too young and androgynous, and besides which, and most important, George would hate it. "What do you plan on doing if you get one of these jobs you're meeting on?" continued Brian. "Well, I mean, it would really depend on the part, you know, but I guess I'd leave. I mean, I know I would, because, I mean..." "I know what you mean," Brian interrupted. The meeting continued, but I was no longer fully present, utterly convinced that I'd screwed up by revealing myself to be so disloyal. Leave my school right in the middle for the first job that came along? Soon after we were done, I shook each man's hand as I moved to the door, heading off to the gallows. George's hand was firm and cool. I returned to the outer office, knowing full well that I would be going back to school. "Miss Fisher," a casting assistant said. I froze, or would have, if we weren't in sunny Los Angeles. "Here are your sides, two doors down. You'll read on video." My heart pounded everywhere a pulse can get to. The scene from Carrie involved the mother, who would be memorably played by Piper Laurie. A dark scene where the people are not okay. But the scene in Star Wars, there were no mothers there. There was authority and confidence and command in the weird language that was used. Was I like this? Hopefully George would think so. And I could pretend I thought so, too. I could pretend I was a princess whose life went from chaos to crisis without looking down between chaoses to find, to her relief, that her dress wasn't torn. I have no recollection now of how I felt reading the two scenes. I can only assume I beat myself up loud and long. Did they like me? Did they think I was fat? Did they think I looked like a bowl of oatmeal with features? Four little dark dots in one big flat pale face. Me, pale face, you tonto. Did they think I looked pretty enough? Was I likable enough for me to relax at all? Not on your life. Because A, there was no relaxing anywhere in my general area, and B, there was no relaxing anywhere in show business. But George must have thought I did well enough to have me back. They sent me the Star Wars script so I could practice it before the last reading. I remember opening the manila envelope. It came in very carefully, one edge at a time, before removing its unknown cargo. It didn't look any different from other scripts. Cardboard-like paper on each end, protecting the ordinary paper within, covered in ant-like scratches of letters. I don't know why, but I wanted to read this screenplay out loud. Enter Miguel Ferrer. Miguel wasn't certain that he wanted to be an actor yet either, like me. But we were both intrigued enough that we continued exploring. Like me, he came from a show business background. His father was the actor Jose Ferrer, and his mother the singer-actress Rosemary Clooney. We were friends, and I called him up and asked him to read the script with me. He arrived at my mother's newer, much smaller house since her dramatically reduced financial circumstances due to a second failed marriage, and we went to my bedroom on the second floor. Like every young man wanting to be an actor in Hollywood then, he also read for the film, so both of us were dimly aware what we were in store for. We sat on my bed and began to read. From the first page, Star Wars, a space fantasy. The images and characters jumped off the pages, not only into our minds, but into the chairs and other furniture that surrounded us. I'm exaggerating a little, but it could have jumped onto the furniture, eaten all of it, and drank the blood of an Englishman because it was as epic as any fee-fi-fo-fum rhyme you ever heard. The images of space opened around us. Planets and stars floated by. The character I was reading for, Leia, was kidnapped by the evil Darth Vader. Kidnapped and hung upside down when the smuggler pilot, Han Solo, who Miguel was reading for, and his giant monkey creature co-pilot, Chewbacca, rescued me. I had been, in the script, upside down and unconscious with yellow eyes. I'll never forget that image. Whoever got the part of the princess named Leia would get to do this. I would potentially get to do this. Maybe, if I was lucky, I would be rescued by Han and Chewbacca, Chewie, from the caverns underneath wherever they tortured me. And then Chewie would carry me, slung over his shoulder, through the thigh-deep water as we made it out of interplanetary harm's way. Unfortunately, none of this imagery was ever realized due to a combination of cost and the fact that Peter Mayhew, who they hired to play Chewie, couldn't, due to his extreme height of over 7 feet, do the stunt because he had a condition that left him unable to stand up quickly and remain stable. It was impossible for him to lift up weight of any kind. And my weight, as everyone at Lucasland can recall, was and remains of the any kind variety. But I can safely say that any girl cast in the part of the feisty Princess Leia would have been of the any kind size, because once Peter was cast, the lifting and being carried through those thigh-high, water-drenched caverns was out. But I also recall hearing that the water-engulfed caverns were quite an expensive set to build, and this was a low-budget film. So, they were out for that reason, too, leaving only Leia's unconsciousness and those yellow eyes. Most of us know how inexpensive unconsciousness is, or was, to achieve, so that wouldn't have been a budget problem, just inappropriate. But by the time you lose Peter's inability to carry any feisty princess, and consider the cost-ineffective underground water caverns, it doesn't matter how beautifully you can portray insensibility, it ain't happening anyway. The Force was put in me in a non-invasive way by the script that day with Miguel, and it has remained in me ever since. I ended up reading for the film with a new actor, an actor I'd never seen before, but then he had never seen me. I'll bet since that reading with me, he's rued the day. If he can get his strong hands on a roux, that is. And if anyone could get their hands on a roux or a woo, it was Harrison Ford. We read together in a room in that same building I'd met George and Brian De Palma in. I was so nervous about the reading, I don't remember much about Harrison. And given how nervous Harrison would come to make me, that was plenty frightened indeed. The following week, my agent, a man who'd been my mother's agent, Wilt Melnick, and was now mine, called me. "Carrie?" he asked. I knew my name, so I let him know I knew it. "Yeah," I said, in a voice very like mine. Mine, but hollow mine. But it didn't matter because my stomach had swung into action. "They called," he said. "Great, because that was really all I wanted to know. If they called, that they called, not what they said, that didn't matter." "They want you," he continued. There was a silence. "They do? I mean, they did?" He laughed. Then I laughed. I laughed and dropped the phone and ran out into the front yard and into the street. It was raining. It didn't rain in L.A. It was raining in L.A., and I was Princess Leia. I had never been Princess Leia before, and now I would be her forever. I would never not be Princess Leia. I had no idea how profoundly true that was and how long forever was. They would pay me nothing and fly me economy, a fact that would haunt my mother for months. But I was Leia, and that was all that truly mattered. I'm Leia. I can live in a tree, but you can't take that away from me. I never dreamt there actually might be a day when I maybe hoped that you could. The Buns of Navarone. The movie was being shot in England, so I could drop out of school, but wouldn't have to leave the scene of the Central School crime. My friend Riggs let me use his flat in Kensington, behind the now-defunct Barker's department store, and that's where I stayed for the 3-month duration of the film. I remember arriving on the set that first day, attempting to seem as benignly unobtrusive as I possibly could. I showed up at the studio in Borehamwood, about 45 minutes out of London, where they fitted me for wardrobe and did hair and makeup tests. The crew was mostly men. That's how it was, and that's pretty much how it still is. It's a man's world, and show business is a man's meal, with women generously sprinkled through it like overqualified spice. The hairstyle that was chosen would impact how everyone, every film-going human, would envision me for the rest of my life, and probably even beyond. It's difficult to imagine any TV obituary not using a photo of that cute little round-faced girl with goofy buns on either side of her inexperienced head. My life had started, all right. Here I was, crossing its threshold in a long, white, virginal robe with the hair of a 17th-century Dutch school matron. I was awarded the part in Star Wars with the dispiriting caveat that I lose 10 pounds. So for me, the experience was less like, all right, I got a job, and more like, I got a job and I hurt my ankle. The minus 10% was an agent's fee in flesh. So I went to a fat farm in Texas. Weren't there any fat farms around Los Angeles? The only answers I can think of are, one, no, because everyone in Los Angeles was already thin, and two, no, because this was 1976, years before the whole exercising, body-obsessed fat farm thing would take hold. The only exercise guru then was Richard Simmons, a flamboyant, fuzzy-haired creature who vaguely resembled a gay Bozo the Clown. Unless that's redundant, which I, thank God, have no way of knowing, having no, thank God, direct experience with Bozo the Clown. My mother recommended the Green Door in Texas, but it was probably called the Golden Door or something else, because the only Green Door that anyone had ever heard of was a porn film, Behind the Green Door, which was known for making its star Marilyn Chambers, if not a household name, then a whore household name. I had seen it at 15, not having heard the word blowjob before. At the Texas Fat Farm, I met Ann Landers, also known as Epi Lederer, a famous advice columnist, and Lady Bird Johnson, who both took me under their overweight wings, which was an uncomfortable place to be. Lady Bird, when I told her the title of Star Wars, thought I'd said car wash, and Ann Landers / Epi Lederer gave me a lot of unsolicited advice over a less-than-filling dinner of a burnt-looking partridge that seemed to have been singed and then torched. It was still more than enough. And with a heavy heart and heavier face, I left a week later. When we started filming, I tried to keep myself well under the radar so that the powers that be wouldn't notice that I hadn't lost the weight they'd asked me to. I only weighed 110 pounds to begin with, but I carried about half of them in my face. I think they may have put those buns on me so they might function as bookends, keeping my face right where it was, between my ears and no bigger. There I would stay, cheeks in check, my face as round as I was short, but no rounder. We usually finish shooting around 6:30 p.m. Monday through Friday. The unluckiest members of the cast, a group that definitely included me, were summoned to the set around 5 a.m. I rose before dawn, was picked up at my flat in Kensington by my cheerful driver, Colin, and was spirited through the largely still-sleeping London to the rosy dawn hem of its outskirts, arriving some 45 minutes later at the less-than-stern guardrail of Boreham Wood Elstree Studios. Why was I asked to arrive at this ungodly hour? What monstrous chain of command had selected me, apart from many others more deserving, more endowed with tresses thick and wavy, tumbling toward their waiting waists? Perhaps by now the sci-fi aficionados have guessed it. Yes, that god-awfully laughable Leia hairstyle. There were two hairpieces that were practically bolted to each side of my head. First one, then the other. These long brown tresses that once latched on grimly were twisted into some oversized cinnamon bun shape, which then, with a deftness that never ceased to amaze me, the hairdresser would very slowly and deliberately wind into the now famous Buns of Navarone. Pat McDermott was the hairdresser assigned to supply me with the hairstyle that I would wear in the movie. Having only worn one hairstyle and shampoo, I couldn't see how this could be anything but a straightforward task. Apply a wig, brush some hair, affix some hairpins, voila, hairstyle. What could be simpler? Well, the straightforward task turned out to be a little more than that when you considered Leia's look would be something worn by children and transvestites and others. So there might have been more responsibility involved than first met the eye. Of course, there was no way to know this initially. So Pat attempted to deliver what was requested of her, an unusual hairstyle to be worn by a 19-year-old girl playing a space princess. Pat was from Ireland and spoke with a lovely Irish brogue, causing, or enabling, depending on the morning, her to refer to the movie as a film. She also called me my lovely or my dearest girl. Isn't this quite an amazing film, my dearest girl? Or, who is this but my darling girl and that crazy hairstyle I put on her each and every day for the new film they're making? I doubt she ever said the latter sentence to me, but she could have, and no one would be any the wiser. Having arrived oh so early in the AM, I would invariably fall asleep in the makeup chair, a plain girl with damp, scraggly hair, falling just past the shoulder of whatever unprepossessing T-shirt I'd worn that day, and would miraculously awaken 2 hours later, transformed from, who the hell is she, into the magnificently mighty mouthful herself, Princess Leia Organa, formerly of Alderaan and presently of anywhere and everywhere she damn well pleased. I had endless issues with my appearance in Star Wars. Real ones, not ones you bring up so people think you're humble because you secretly find yourself adorable. What I saw in the mirror is not apparently what many teenage boys saw. If I'd known about all the masturbating I would generate, well, that would have been extraordinarily weird from many angles, and I'm glad it didn't come up, as it were. But when men, 50-year-old plus men, down to, well, the age goes pretty low for statutory comfort, when men approach me to let me know that I was their first love, let's just say I have mixed feelings. Why did all these men find it so easy to be in love with me then and so complex to be in love with me now? I had no idea how much time Pat and I would spend together. She was the first person I saw in the morning and the last person I saw at night. But it was the morning bit that was the most intimate. Because the hair took 2 hours to style, we spent inordinate amounts of time coming up with conversation. The horror is sitting with someone silently. It's the conversational low. Sure, you can turn on music and sit or stand there smiling vaguely, trying to pretend there's nowhere else you'd rather be. But the sketches of hairstyles that Pat had been given to use as a guideline were shown to me. I looked at her aghast, with much like the expression I used when shown the sketches of the metal bikini later on, the one I wore to kill Jabba, my favorite moment in my own personal film history, which I highly recommend your doing. Find an equivalent of killing a giant space slug in your head and celebrate that. It works wonders when I'm plagued by dark images of my hairy earphones. So, Pat showed me a variety of exotic looks, from Russian princesses to Swedish maids. I looked at the images, slightly alarmed. There was no Lady Gaga to guide me. These are meant to be worn by me? Pat smiled sympathetically. Not all of them, just one. And I'm sure they won't want you to wear anything you don't like. I regarded her doubtfully. Those sounded like famous last words. You worry too much, Pat laughed, smoothing my hair back. Sorry about my accent. So, image by image, we went through hairstyles that would look best when accompanied by clogs, an apron, and puffy white sleeves. A hairstyle probably sported by an Aztec Indian chief's daughter on her wedding day. Swirling braids, flowing tresses, and towering wigs. I would sit miserably in front of a mirror and watch while hairstyles did to my face what funhouse mirrors do to yours. This isn't a hairdo, it's a hair don't. Pat would politely laugh at what I hoped would pass for a wordplay and continue combing, pinning, spraying, and teasing. And after each new hairstyle, I would stand back at the mirror, gaze at the face, and struggle to make peace with my appearance. Was I round-faced and adorable-looking? Of course. I see that from this devious distance. But most of us look better at a distance. Eventually, we arrived at the hairy earphone configuration. Well, what do you think of this one, darling? Be honest now. You're going to have to wear this hairstyle for a long while. She had no idea exactly how long. It's okay, I managed. I mean, I liked it better than a lot of the others. I mean, no offense, but... Oh, please, darling, no offense taken. I'm just trying to give them what they want, though I'm not sure they know precisely what that is. Can't it be something simpler? I mean, why does the hair have to be, you know, so... It's an outer space, Philip, my lovely. We can't have you larking about wearing what I think you call a ponytail. And here she yanked on my very own ponytail. With a fringe, can we now? I was silent. I thought the ponytail, after all the braids and hair pieces, sounded... If not good, preferable. No, indeed. So let's you and me give the powers that be another little show, shall we? Okay, I responded briskly. Let's get in there and kick some. Pat looked at me and I smiled too broadly. Fuck me twice and cover me with applesauce. We strolled onto the set, Pat looking clear-eyed and straight-backed with her silver hair and bright blue eyes, me looking as if all I needed was a dirndl, a goat, and clogs to be ready to take my place in the Sound of Music. We arrived at a small troupe of traveling minstrels. No, I'm kidding. I wish we'd arrived at a small troupe of traveling anything, instead of this group of three. The first assistant director, Dave Tomlin, the producer, Gary Kurtz, who might have been smiling under his usual fashion choice, a Quaker-bearded straight face, and George. Well, George practically said. Dave Tomlin spoke for the entire group when he repeated the same thing he'd said after at least six previous hair don'ts. I think this one is quite flattering, Gary finished. What do you think of it? George asked me. Now remember, I hadn't lost the requisite 10 pounds, and I thought any minute they'd notice and fire me before the film even started. So, naturally, I replied, I love it!